It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with the Splendid Table. Today, it's the Big Bird Big Time, our annual Thanksgiving show. We've got one of America's great cooks, San Francisco star chef Judy Rogers. She's got a modern yet homey menu packed with little tricks to get the most out of every forkful. I take on Thanksgiving sans bird, a meatless feast. For those who make reservations, the Stearns have turkey three ways in three states. For those who tote, wine maverick Josh Wesson has great bargain bubbly and after-dinner sippers. We have Thanksgiving in Potluck Nation, Florida, and Southern novelist Pat Conroy talks his life at the stove. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today it's our annual Thanksgiving bash. Award-winning San Francisco chef Judy Rogers has a menu of new yet wonderfully homey dishes. She has got a roasting technique that frees up the oven and a stuffing idea you're going to love. Her book is the Zuni Cafe Cookbook. Wine maverick Josh Wesson makes you non-cooks shine. Just bring along his bargain picks of great bubblies or the world's best cream sherry. We hear the story behind a Japanese concentration camp cookbook, a biography of love, war, and food. Southern novelist Pat Conroy reveals his other love, cooking. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things started the way we do every week with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by Starbucks, collecting books and toys at neighborhood locations for this year's Holiday Angels Joy Drive. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael, if you could do a dream Thanksgiving meal in all the places that you've been to, where would you go?
Well, first of all, let me define dream Thanksgiving meal. My idea of a dream Thanksgiving meal is somebody else doing all the cooking and all the work, and I get to eat all the turkey I want and then lie in a tryptophan daze in my bed for the next day. So with that in mind, we have three places for you.
Okay, we're traveling. It's a progressive dinner.
All right, well, let's start way out west at a restaurant called Huber's Cafe in Portland, Oregon. It's been there over a century, and it's one of these wonderful kind of wood-paneled old places. We were originally attracted to it because it is a home of absolutely classic meat and potatoes square meals. The specialty of the house, the squarest of square meals, is the full-bore turkey dinner. However, one of the things that you can get at Huber's, which is better than any other place I've had it, is that one great, big, delicious turkey drumstick.
Mm.
But what's different about this turkey drumstick, as opposed to, say, the ones you get at state fairs all around the country, is that it is drippingly moist. You know, sometimes they have a tendency to dry out. And the whole point of eating dark meat, after all, is for its moistness and succulence and juiciness. This is the moistest, most succulent, juicy drumstick I have ever
had. Yeah, and it's delicious. And they have the best sage dressing, which isn't overpowering. It's wonderful.
And I should mention, just if you're not a classicist as we are, you can also go to Huber's for turkey piccata or also turkey stir fry with prawns. Now, we have tried neither of those, so we don't know how they are.
Not for Thanksgiving. No, thank you. All right, but what's your second place?
Okay, moving along, we have turkey hash at Charlie's Sandwich Shop in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Now, this is nothing but a wonderful local South End diner. I mean, and that's what it is. I mean, formica, counter seating. I think there are some tables as well. And what you eat there is turkey hash that fills the plate. I mean, you get one plate covered with nothing but turkey hash, topped with a couple of eggs, of course. And if you get the hash kind of well done, it's got a wonderful sort of crisp edge to it and crisp top. But below that is the moist turkey, potatoes, and onions that is just so comforting.
Okay, and third.
All right.
My personal favorite, Hart's Turkey Farm in Meredith, New Hampshire, for, ta-da-da-da, turkey croquettes.
Or any other kind of turkey. But in this case, we're talking about
croquettes.
Where
do you get croquettes anymore? I mean, they don't exist, but they do here.
Now, how do they do them? I mean, these are little fried balls of ground turkey.
Well, they're more
and stuff.
They're triangular in shape.
Do you remember what the mountain in Close Encounters of the Third?
Yes. I
Close
remember
Encounters
that.
Of the Third.
Devil's
Sorry.
Tower. Yeah.
Yeah, Devil's Tower. They're sort
mini
of like
Devil's Towers.
They're mini Devil's Towers, breaded and deep fried and made with turkey.
Now, we should say, though, that Hart's, I mean, the main, as good as the croquettes are, I mean, you can get a regular, wonderful turkey dinner. You can get turkey tempura, turkey parmesan, turkey nuggets, turkey livers, turkey pie, turkey marsala, and turkey divan as well.
I like turkey divan.
Now, do they actually, I mean, they do really raise the turkeys.
Oh, yeah. You can go outside and watch them gobble or listen to them gobble.
But you don't really have to because, I mean, some people get creeped out by, you know, seeing the thing walking around that they're then going to eat. So you can just run into
the
restaurant.
Well, you don't select the turkey you're about to eat.
Right. You don't point to it with the finger
I think
death.
We can stop discussing this now. It's all right. Okay.
Let's
so
eat.
We've got I see a progression here. We eat. We have the great turkey drumstick out in Portland, and then I see the hash and the croquettes is what we do maybe that night
right,
or the next.
The next
this is
day.
Great. Hey,
absolutely, because it'll take you that long to fly from Portland to Meredith, New Hampshire. So then it'll be leftovers.
It works for me. Hey, happy Thanksgiving, you two.
Thank you, Lynn. You
bye,
too.
Lynn.
Bye.
Turkey for the girls and turkey for the boys. My favorite kind of pants are corduroys. Gobble, gobble, goo, and gobble, gobble, giggle. I wish turkey only cost a nickel. Oh, I love turkey on Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
That's Adam Sandler, and that is the only clean verse in the whole song. Now, the Stearns are author of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And for those who don't do bird, I suggest that this year you sidestep the tofurkey and think pie. Deep dish pie. Now, I am talking pie like Henry VIII had pie, a showstopper. Now, you imagine this, a big baking dish covered with a gorgeous golden crust set in the middle of the table. You dig in your spoon and you get this whoosh of fabulously fragrant veggies. Now, here's my theory. Almost any great tasting vegetable dish becomes a very uptown feast if you bake it under a crust. Now, the crust could even be store-bought puff pastry or pie dough. The trick to making it golden is to brush the crust with egg yolk before you bake it. You could even decorate it with pastry cutouts. So I've put together a recipe for a celebration pie based on roasted winter vegetables. You can find the whole thing on the website. It's called Golden Celebration Pie of Winter Vegetables. Go to splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert turned maverick. Now, he thinks wine is a democratic drink, like beer, something you should enjoy with almost anything, from Big Macs to Thai takeout. And he believes there's a lot of good wine out there for not a lot of money. Josh is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Josh, welcome back.
I'm extremely happy to be here.
Josh, this is the time of year that if you're not asked to bring a dish for Thanksgiving, you're asked to bring the wine. Give me some thoughts, because if ever there was a menu that is a nightmare to match wine with, it's Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's true. It's so easy to get lost in all the sauces when you're a guest at Thanksgiving and you try to think ahead of all the dishes that are going to be on the table and pair wine with them. So my advice is forget the stuff in the middle of the meal, because you don't even know what it's going to be half the time when you go to someone's house, and concentrate on the bookends of the dinner. Bring something that's going to be a great starter, or bring something that you know is going to go with the desserts at the end.
That's a great idea. Okay, so now what should we be thinking about?
Well, I think that there's nothing better as a starter at Thanksgiving than sparkling wine, and in particular, sparkling wines that are made from dark grapes. They have a little bit more richness, a little bit more depth. Sometimes they can even edge into the world of rosé, but they're festive, they're different, because most people don't drink rosé or dark-skinned sparkling wine. And they are great with everything from olives and nuts to cheeses. Again, you're not going to worry about what foods they're going to be paired with. You're just going to bring high odds of deliciousness, wines that are going to go on the table. And of course, the great thing about bringing wine at Thanksgiving is it's going to end up in your glass at one point or another. I hate bringing wine as gift to a friend and then they never open it. You're always wondering, I hate that.
So give me some picks for bubblies.
Well, the good news is they don't have to be champagne. In fact, I'm going to give you three recommendations that aren't champagne. There's a Spanish cava made by Cristalino that happens to be a full-blown rosado, which is their word for rosé. It sells for $12, and it is a phenomenally delicious wine. It's one of those wines that once you start drinking it, you can't stop. And that's why if you bring it to Thanksgiving, you better make sure that you get the first glass out, because it'll be gone before you get there.
Yeah, but at $12 a bottle, I can afford to bring enough.
Bring two or three. Why not? And if you ratchet it up a little bit, California makes a lot of great sparkling wine. Domaine Chandon has been a Blanc de Noir, a white wine from dark grape specialist for years and years and years. And they make an absolutely delicious Blanc de Noir that goes for around $20 and would also be a fantastic starter.
And another one?
Australia. You know, people think of Australia for Shiraz, maybe for Semillon, but they really think of it as a source of sparkling wine. But Taltarni, which is known for making great reds, also happens to make a fabulous rosé sparkling wine called Brut Tâche. And it's $24, and it's the wine that I'm going to be serving, even though I'm cooking. I'm going to be serving it as a starter at Thanksgiving, and I think you cannot lose. People will love you. They'll bring you back for more, and they'll want to know where you got that wine.
Okay, so now what about the other end of the meal? You said bring something for the bookends. What about the right. other end?
You drink whatever's around for the middle of the meal, and then by the time you get to the end. Have
you
a
don't
fortified
care.
Wine.
Oh,
no,
have a,
you
oh,
don't care.
Oh, okay. No, but fortified wine, though. Which one?
Well, you know, don't do a traditional port. Do a Zinfandel port. It's an American fortified wine. It's patriotic. It's wrapping up this American holiday. Montevigna makes a wonderful one. It's under $20. Fantastic. And you could go in a couple of other directions with fortified wine. You could get a great cream sherry. Here's a place where that Harvey's Bristol that's been sitting gathering dust on the shelf would be good. But why don't you trump it by bringing the absolute best cream sherry made in the world? And here's the great thing about this wine. It costs less than $20, and it is the best cream sherry on the planet.
What is it?
It's made by Lustau, and it's called Solera Superior Rare Cream. It's not rare, though. They make a lot of it, and it goes for $17, $18, and it will just impress everyone. And I can't think of a better wine to end Thanksgiving meal with.
This is great with all those intense flavors. Okay. Hey, Josh, happy Thanksgiving.
And to you.
Josh Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. And you can find Josh's wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Now, every week we send you a recipe for a fast supper dish, and we also send along shopping and technique tips. Best of all, thanks to those cows, it's free. You can register for it online at splendidtable.org. Oh, and we've got more news. The Splendid Table crew has wanderlust. And we're satisfying it by taking off to Italy. This spring, we're taking a trip to my beloved Emilia-Romagna region. Well, you can visit it too. And by the way, this is not a bad idea for a great holiday gift. You can find details, well, they're on that website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a Thanksgiving menu from San Francisco Chef of the Year. And for a little balance, Potluck Nation. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find modern takes on old-time classics like angel food cake, quiche, and garlic bread. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. When people talk of exceptional talents in American restaurants, there's one cook who's always high on the list. She is Judy Rogers, chef and co-owner of San Francisco's Zuni Cafe. Judy's food is the essence of grace and simplicity. Now, this woman does not torture ingredients. She just lets them sing. The Zuni Cafe cookbook, and I rarely say this about a book, is an extraordinary accomplishment. Here's a chef with a profound understanding of flavor, clearly communicating that understanding to a home cook. And this is why I wanted Judy Rogers to talk to us about Thanksgiving. Judy, welcome.
Thank you.
Judy, how did you get interested in food?
My goodness, I had the stroke of luck of a lifetime. As a high school senior, I was an exchange student, and the home, the foster home I was placed in, was a hotel restaurant called Les Frères Trois Gros, which a couple people in America may still know as was a very famous three-star restaurant in France, which at the time was deemed by many to be the best in the world. And I simply lived there as a high school student. I got to spend, you know, all my waking hours when I wasn't taking philosophy classes at school in the kitchen, watching and tasting and taking prodigious notes on everything I saw.
Did they take you seriously? I mean, you were a kid from the United States, and you know, or did they just try to shoo you away?
Not at all. You know, they took me. I think they took me more lovingly than seriously. They saw that, you know, I was interested and that I appreciated what they were doing, and you know, it was a very sort of nurturing thing.
So, from a teenager in a French kitchen to a famous chef in San Francisco, to the reason we have brought you here today, Judy, we would love for you to give us a menu for Thanksgiving. And as I remember, you have some pretty strong theories about roasting. So tell me, how do you roast that turkey?
Well, the first thing I do, I choose a fairly, you know, a small turkey, like 10 to 15 pounds. I prefer toms. And what I always do is I put the turkey in a saltwater brine. I leave it in there for a day. And then I take it out and put it in my refrigerator for that brine to soak in. And that helps make the turkey be seasoned all the way through. It also helps keep it juicy. And then, you know, I roast it at a, you know, pretty constant, say 325, 350. Mm-hmm. And I don't take it all the way up to that, you know, extremely high temperature you see in all the books, because I always let my turkey and anything else I'm roasting rest for, you know, 20, 30, 40 minutes, and during that time it's out of the oven as it's resting, which I consider part of roasting. The temperature in the middle keeps rising. So the turkey actually finishes cooking outside the oven, and that's pretty much the secret to making sure it's not too dry. And it comes out absolutely succulent and juicy, and you know, by the time you carve it, it's fully cooked. It's not at all undercooked in the middle, so you don't have to worry about that, but it's still quite juicy, and it's absolutely delicious.
So what temperature, if I stick one of those instant reading thermometers in the thigh, what temperature would it be when I take it out of the oven?
I'm going to pull it at about between 155, 159, but not to worry. It will be much more done.
Okay. Well, all right. Now let's talk menu, okay?
Okay.
Because you've got a real style to your food. It's so simple, but it tastes so good. What kind of menu do you suggest for this Thanksgiving?
Well, you know, I'm a little bit, you know, different than some people. I don't really want to cover the buffet with more dishes than I can keep track of. I'd rather, for Thanksgiving, I try to choose, you know, a handful of absolutely delicious, indulgent, seductive, gorgeous dishes that I know I can make very, very well and that don't take me, you know, all week to prepare. For a first course, one of the things that I think is absolutely delicious and very festive is, and also just a little bit Italian, because even though I'm not Italian, I think I ought to have been, is just a simple first course of a cured meat, say a dried Parma prosciutto or a Sandagnelli or a smoked prosciutto with slivers of ripe persimmon and a trickle of one of your favorite things, an aged balsamic vinegar. Oh. And if you wanted to add another little note, maybe a few fresh pecans would taste really good because they're nutty and also feel very Thanksgiving-y. And it makes a very simple, you know, unfussy, easy to present first course.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in terms of the turkey, you know, having talked about how I roast it, I would love to serve it with a very simple side dish of hashed sweet potatoes. And to do that, all you have to do is peel and grate the sweet potatoes and then just cook them in unsalted butter with a pinch of salt in a big nonstick pan or on a griddle if you have one. And they make a really lacy, crispy galette that's absolutely gorgeous. As a side vegetable, I might just make some really simple wilted escarole, again, in a little bit of butter with salt and a splash of water so it stays bright green and it gets tender. And then in terms of a stuffing, I'm not a big stuff inside the turkey girl. I like the crispy texture of baked stuffings. And in fact, what I thought of doing is adapting my famous or infamous sometimes bread salad, which is based on a traditional Tuscan bread salad. And it's made with chunks of day or 2 day old Tuscan style white bread that are lightly toasted and tossed with vinaigrette and pine nuts and bitter greens and some of the drippings from the turkey. And where I usually toss in some dried currant raisins, I think for Thanksgiving it might be fun to toss in some dried cranberries because that would make it more festive and, you know, pick up on what everybody's looking for on that Thanksgiving buffet.
And then what about dessert?
Well, I'd sneak in a tiny little cheese course because I think the idea of serving, say, a really nice blue cheese, say a Stilton or an Italian Gorgonzola would be perfectly appropriate with, say, a few slivers of anise, or some people refer to it as fennel bulb, is a really nice way to break between the bounty of the meal before you take on dessert. And I would just serve that on a platter and let people serve themselves as much as they want. And it sort of slows things down and allows people to talk.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit and pause before dessert. For dessert, I was thinking of serving a beautiful pear tart, which is very simple, just a rich pastry crust. And I like serving that tart with a dollop of creme fraiche, which is a slightly acidulated cream that you can either make yourself with buttermilk and cream or buy a traditional style creme fraiche, which is more available now in America.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
Judy Rogers is chef owner of San Francisco's Zuni Cafe. She's author of the Zuni Cafe cookbook. Now, we have posted Judy's entire Thanksgiving menu on the website. Just go to splendidtable.org. How many times have you watched all that Thanksgiving organizing, advance legwork, and cajoling of relatives turn into a day best forgotten? At times like that, I always think that there's some parallel universe where all is peaceful, loving, and delicious. Well, writer Julie Hauserman may be living in that universe.
This Thanksgiving, while you're making the gravy and fighting with your teenager and hoping your drunk Uncle Ben doesn't fall into the Uncle Ben's, I will be making potatoes. Just potatoes. I don't have to cook a turkey or green bean casserole or yams with marshmallows on top. I don't have to whip up a pumpkin pie or make sure I have enough plates for the crowd. I don't have to bridge that cavernous social gap between my in-laws and my parents. I don't have to turn on a televised football game. How, you may ask, is this possible? Am I a college student, a loner, a loser? No. I am a proud citizen of Potluck Nation. At a potluck, nobody is the beleaguered keeper of Thanksgiving. We're all in it together. My community is a land cooperative in the countryside outside Tallahassee, Florida. It is also a sovereign potluck nation, although no one's given it that name before. This Thanksgiving will be the 31st since the land co-op began in 1973 as part of the Back to the Land movement. Most of the so-called intentional communities that sprung up around that time are gone now. The guru they followed turned out to be a jerk, or too many people gave up and moved back to the city, or maybe they were trying too much togetherness, like sharing housing or money. I'm convinced that my community has endured longer than most because of potlucks. We love to eat. We love to cook. And we love to share what we cook with our friends. There's the progressive dinner on New Year's Eve with cocktails and appetizers at one house, soup and salad at another, entrees at another, and finally the dessert house. Then we dance to a hired band. For years, my community held a potluck dinner every Monday at the home of one of our neighbors who was dying of cancer. They brought healing food and naughty food because you can eat as much naughty food as you like if you're dying. She died and died well with love around her, and the potlucks live on. Then there's Thanksgiving, my favorite potluck. The first year I went, I didn't know what to expect. I wasn't living in the co-op then, but a friend invited us. "What can I bring?" I asked. How about mashed potatoes?" my friend said. "Okay, for how many people?" 40," he said. "Okay," I said. And then I started thinking, mashed potatoes for 40? How many is that? A lot of potatoes. I went to the store and bought bags full. Being young newlyweds, my husband and I didn't even have a big pot. We borrowed one, and I remember us in that tiny apartment kitchen mashing those potatoes with wooden spoons, the giant pot set on the floor. Many Thanksgivings have come and gone since that day. At Potluck Nation, we've developed a system so that we don't end up with just one turkey and 50 side dishes. We divide ourselves into smaller neighborhood groups, and each group brings an entire Thanksgiving feast from the turkey down to the cranberries and pumpkin pie. So we'll end up with 7 turkeys and a giant baked grouper fish stuffed with oysters and lemons and 20 pies and dozens of dishes filled with stuffing and sweet potatoes and veggies and fresh baked bread and mashed potatoes, lots of them. We gather in a circle out in the field beside our community center, and we give thanks. The kids sneak in and try to steal all the desserts before we get done. After dinner, some of us play football in the field, and some of us sit like slugs, just happy to be here in Potluck Nation.
Julie Hauserman is a freelance writer living and working in Tallahassee, Florida. Food plays a unique role in Thanksgiving. There's no other holiday on America's calendar that is entirely about the feast. And there are a lot of powerful symbols floating around that table. I mean, look, food's belonging, it's love, it's security, it's control. Food had those meanings and a lot more in the life of a British woman named Lilla Eckford. Lilla lived an extraordinary life for 100 years, from 1882 to 1982. Much of that time in China. Her great-granddaughter, Frances Osborne, tells Lilla's story in her book, Lilla's Feast, a true story of food, love, and war in the Orient. Frances Osborne, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me, what was Lilla like?
Oh, then she was extraordinary. As my mother said, she's just not like other old ladies. Even at the age of 100, she would perch on the edge of a sofa, wearing these tight little black lace cardigans with makeup on, her hair up, always with gold necklace and earrings or diamond earrings. And you would walk into the room as a young, well, as a child or a sort of girl, as I was then, and she would lean forward and whisper that it was wonderful to see you. And we were captivated by her. She had such presence. It was extraordinary.
Now, tell me a little bit about her life. Where she was born in China, right?
Yes, she was born in a small trading port in China in 1882. It was a colonial trading port, but a colony that didn't belong to any particular country, but was, you know, any non-Chinese nationality that wanted to do business in China could set up there. It was called Chifu, and it was one of the seaside holiday resorts for all the foreigners living in the much more famous port of Shanghai.
Frances, the subtitle of the book is Food, Love, and War in the Orient. Now, how did food play in Lilla's life?
Food played a very important role in Lilla's life. From an early age, she was brought up to appreciate and value food. Her mother was an extremely keen cook, So Lilla's own sort of early memories were of wolfing down combinations of sort of British bread and butter pudding with northern Chinese sort of noodles and seafood. But it was only when Lilla grew up and left home and started to make her own life that food began to take on a quite extraordinary significance for her.
What was that significance?
Well, being a younger identical twin, as Lilla was, she was born 30 minutes after her sister, who seemed to have taken all the good luck with her when she was born first. When her eldest sister became engaged to a handsome young officer in the aftermath of the Boxer Rebellion in China, Lilla raced to catch up and rushed into marrying one of his friends, a man called Ernie Howell, who's my great-grandfather. However, the marriage didn't go so well. Ernie took her to England, and he told her there that he'd made a terrible mistake in marrying her, and that she wasn't worth the cost of keeping with him when he was sent off to his next posting, which was in India, and he was therefore going to leave her alone with their small child, with his family, who made it quite clear that they disliked her intensely. Lilla, if she was left alone, faced a lifetime of misery and freedom, dependency on in-laws who didn't like her, an inability to return to her family in China without facing huge public humiliation. And she knew if she wanted any chance of happiness in life, even if it was with this slightly brutish husband, she had to win him round. And she did that by quite literally cooking her way to his heart.
So Lilla, by World War II, Lilla is in a Japanese concentration camp in China. How did she survive this?
Well, Lilla's first husband died in the First World War, and she went back to China and rebuilt the most fantastic life for herself. And it was the happiest time of her life. And suddenly, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in December 1941, all of this was taken away from her. And she was put into a prison camp. So she turned instinctively to what had saved her before, and this was food and cooking. And not just any sort of cooking, but specifically cooking and homemaking for new brides. Lilla sat down in this concentration camp, and she was allowed to take a suitcase in with her, and in that suitcase she put a typewriter. In order to keep herself busy, she sat down and typed out an entire recipe book for new brides.
So Frances, where did the recipe book go?
When she was released from the camp in 1945, Lilla hid this recipe book at the bottom of her suitcase, and she ended up as a refugee in Britain for the rest of her life. But it wasn't until 1977, when her identical twin had died, that Lilla produced this manuscript of a recipe book from the bottom of her suitcase. And it's the most extraordinary book because it's typed on any scraps she could find. It's a Red Cross paper, bits of receipts, old sort of notepaper that had been written on one side. And it's as though all the sort of paper and recipes seem to have absorbed the atmosphere of the camp into it. You turn them, and although the words you're reading are, you know, how to make pavlovas and ice creams and great big pies and things they were never eating in the camp, you sense the sort of hope and desperation in it. And the recipe book is now in the Imperial War Museum in London, where it's quite sort of a fitting place for it.
What a story. Frances, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Frances Osborne is the author of her great-grandmother's biography, Lilla's Feast, a true story of food, love, and war in the Orient. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what aspirations did Benjamin Franklin have for the turkey? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what aspirations did Ben Franklin have for the turkey? Well, Ben Franklin wanted to see the turkey on the top of flagpoles, on our money, on the presidential seal. He wanted it to be the symbol of the United States. Franklin detested the eagle, and he ranted about it in a letter to his daughter in 1784. He said, "The eagle is a bird of bad moral character. He steals, he's lazy, he's unkempt. The eagle is a rank coward, and it is not an American bird. It exists in Europe. This is the last creature we should choose to represent our brave new venture." Then Mr. Franklin turns to the turkey. Now, to paraphrase, he says, "In contrast to the vile eagle, the turkey is first and foremost an American, native to our land, and a brave and moral bird which defends its barnyard against all comers." Franklin does add that the turkey is, and I'm quoting here, "a little vain and silly, but that is not the worst emblem for a new nation." The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Jerry on the line from Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Jerry. Hi. What do you want to talk about?
Well, all kinds of things, but actually two basic questions. They both have to do with beans. I have a restaurant in Burlington, Vermont, and you have said on the show, and I've heard elsewhere, that beans should be bought and used in the same year that they're grown. But I'm wondering, if you have beans that are over a year old, are they just, you just throw them away? Or
No. No, 1,000 times no. But what happens is, like everything else, the longer beans are kept, the less bright flavor they have.
I see.
But it gets, you know, it gets a little complicated, because as you know, no two beans taste exactly alike.
Yeah.
You know, black-eyed peas taste very earthy, and they tend to hold on to that for quite a long time. Things like pinto beans can be very sweet, or Anasazi beans. And I guess the idea is that the fresher the beans are, generally, the more flavor you get out of them. And also, the faster they cook.
Right. Oh, I see. So it is partly a question of dryness, then.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's one of those deals where if you can get the beans where there's kind of a fast turnover, and by the way, that might be the supermarket.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, you know, nobody ever puts a date on beans 99% of the time. But people always say to me, don't you buy imported dried beans from Europe? Well, yeah, they can be wonderful. But if I buy them in a store where I know they've been sitting on the shelf for 3 years, I'm probably not going to get my money's worth.
I have a second question, sort of a follow-up to this. And that is, it's an Asian restaurant, and beans are generally traditional in an Asian restaurant. But we do a lot of vegetarian food, and I would like to make a bean, not burger exactly, but a bean cake.
A bean cake.
Yes,
yeah.
And to make it most palatable to vegans, which we have many of as customers, what can I do to hold it together apart from eggs?
That's a good question, and what you're hearing now is somebody.
Arrowroot? Would arrowroot do it?
Well, it's starchy. You could try that, but I'm just wondering, like, for instance, if you do mashed beans of one kind, like maybe a black bean, which has a really great flavor, and then you stud that with chickpeas, or you stud that with a soybean, but you really season up that black bean mash beautifully. The other thing you could do is something like sweet potato.
with the bean, right? And the other thing is tarot. Do you ever work with tarot?
We do use tarot. Well, not as much as I'd like to, but we do use tarot.
Yeah, because, you know, when you mash tarot, it's pretty sticky.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, but I'm thinking is that whatever you use, it can be the carrier of great flavors.
Yes, that's right.
You know, ginger and chili and that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of flavors we would use. But I like your idea of the sweet potatoes. That really sounds delicious.
Yeah, and you could have little chunks of them. You could have them mashed, and then you have the beans studded in there.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I know.
Take care. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Jeannie on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Jeannie, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I'm confused about coriander, cumin, and cilantro. I know in the past that I have planted coriander and gotten cilantro. But when I crushed coriander, I didn't get cumin. So can you please tell me what I've done wrong?
No, you haven't done anything wrong. It's so confusing. This is a question essentially of language, okay?
Yes.
Coriander and cilantro are exactly the same thing.
Okay.
And you use them two ways. You use the fresh green as you planted. It resembles parsley in appearance,
yes.
Right? And the interesting thing, you know, about fresh coriander, which you probably saw as a gardener, it has three different shaped leaves if you look closely, which, you know, is weird. But anyway, that's fresh coriander. Okay. Cilantro is Spanish for it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
And by the way, here's the other thing. Whenever you see Chinese parsley mentioned in a recipe.
Yes. Now that I knew was cilantro.
Right.
And I didn't know it was coriander.
Yeah. Coriander's English for all of that.
Okay.
Okay. Now, cumin is a completely separate spice. All right. And usually you don't get fresh green cumin. What you get is the seed, and it's kind of an oval-shaped seed, and often it's ground into a powder.
Yeah.
And you can also get a seed from coriander. Those look like little mustard seeds. They're round, okay, and that's literally the seed of the plant. So cumin has this really kind of woodsy, almost a little, what would you call it? Fusky, I call it. You know, kind of a mushroomy aroma to it, but it's fabulous in food.
I love it. I love it. In fact, just recently, my husband went to purchase the crushed and brought home the seed because he couldn't find the crushed. And I've been using it as I did the crushed cumin before.
Isn't it fabulous?
It's so aromatic.
You know, one of the great things to do with it, toast it in a dry skillet just for about 5 minutes until it's aromatic. Oh, it is unbelievable. It's an Indian trick from India where you'll sprinkle that on top of mashed potatoes or on top of a salad. You can put it on anything,
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think cumin is fabulous. And cumin, dried cumin and dried coriander, whenever anyone says dried coriander, they mean the seed.
Yeah.
They're paired constantly in Mexico. They're paired in India and much of Southeast Asia because there's this natural marriage. So now you've got it. And no, you're in very good company with this confusion.
Yes. It sounds like I am.
Thanks for a good basic question.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Mark calling from Kirkland, Washington. Mark, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn. I'm just a typical dad who wants to maximize my family stores. Hopefully not killing off my family by way of food poisoning, which brings me to the question of mold.
I beg your pardon.
mold. We've all got it. We don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
Mold on bread, mold on cheese, mold on fruit. When can I cut it off and use the rest? When do I throw it all away?
This is a very important question.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, okay. Mold on cheese, there's a simple rule. If it's small and it's on a hard cheese, cut away the whole mold with about a half inch of the cheese around it and eat the cheese as soon as you can, but the cheese will generally be saved. Mold on soft cheeses, because the mold spores tend to spread more readily in soft or liquid things like mold. You know, if you have mold on jelly, if you have mold on yogurt, if you have mold on tomato sauce, if you have mold on soft cheese, toss the food. Because those mold spores, which sometimes they're not toxic, they just can't be digested or they can make people sick perhaps. You don't want those. Now, Mold on fruit, if it's only a very small spot, cut away that and everything around it that's discolored. If there is any of fresh-looking fruit left, sniff it. I'm serious. If it smells off, don't eat it. And also, I wouldn't feed that fruit to people who have any kind of compromised immune system. I wouldn't feed it to little ones. I wouldn't feed it to pregnant women. But if it's a little teeny piece of mold because it's been sitting airless, you know, on one side of itself, that you can cut away. But if the whole thing is covered and is one tiny, forget it. It's not worth it.
Okay.
It's not worth it. Now, when it comes to bread, quite frankly, again, bread is usually a soft product. Unless the mold is just on the edge, and I'll cut it off, and then I'll sniff my bread to see if it smells funky.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I usually toss it.
Lose it. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, mold loves moisture, right? So if you can keep things on the dry side then and airy, then generally you're not going to get a mold development.
Excellent.
Well, okay.
This is just as intuition would dictate, then. This makes a lot of sense.
Isn't it nice when it's logical?
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, I know. I offer thanks every time it gets this logical.
Thank you for your help.
Hey, you're welcome.
Take care.
You too. You know, when I was a kid, our Thanksgiving table was always about telling stories. The adults sat over coffee and they talked about memories and adventures and hunting exploits. A lot of exaggeration ran around that table. They were good storytellers, but I think nobody tells stories like a Southerner. And few Southerners tell them like Pat Conroy. You probably know his books like Prince of Tides, My Losing Season. Well, now he's done a collection of recipes and stories. The Pat Conroy Cookbook, Recipes of My Life. Pat Conroy, welcome.
Nice talking to you, Lynn.
Pat, do you see this book as a collection of stories with recipes or recipes with stories? Is it people or is it food?
You know, I wanted it to be a combination of both. I'd always wanted to do cookbooks, you know, since I first became interested in cooking. That I can cook today is one of the magic parts of my life that I was not expecting. And I grew up in a house with a woman who could not cook, and she is famous for her bad cooking. And the only person I know that was a worse cook was my grandmother, her mother. And so the loving of food was something that I came to very late. And I wanted to combine my love of story with also the love of great meals that I've enjoyed with my friends over the years.
Well, if you had to pick one person, who put you on that path?
Well, it would have to be my first wife, Barbara. She went to law school at Emory in Atlanta and told me that I was going to be responsible for the evening meal each night because she would be at the library. So I cooked nothing then, and I went down to a bookstore, a used bookstore, and I said, the owner was Cliff Graubart. I said, Cliff, do you have any good cookbooks for sale? And he said, I hear Escoffier is good.
He was one of the great chefs of
one
France.
Well, I'd never heard of it. You know, so I take this cookbook, Escoffier, and I open the first page, and he says, if you do not make good stock, you should not eat. And I had no idea what stock was. So with Monsieur Escoffier leading me by the hand, I made a brown stock, I made a white stock, I made a fish stock, I made a veal stock, and then he allowed me to start cooking.
You were on your way to opening a restaurant, Pat.
And I had never heard of this in my life. But he convinced me that you had to do this. And what he was doing was giving me a very basic course in fine food, high cuisine.
Pat, you talk about in the Pat Conroy cookbook that you never really had a home until you were in your early teens. What happened then?
Well, you know, Dad, my father was in the Marine Corps. And when my father was dying, he asked me if I wanted to know where I had lived since I was born. And he had a little notebook. And he took me through, and I found out by the time I got to Beaufort, South Carolina, when I was 15 years old, it was my 23rd move. And because of this, you know, I longed for a home, longed for a place, you know, I could call my own.
Well, did Beaufort become home?
Oh, Beaufort did. I latched onto this place like a barnacle. And I simply called it my hometown from the time I was 15 until today. And I am grateful to this small town on the coast more than any place in the world, because it embraced me, it took me in, called me brother, called me townsman, and finally called me native son. Here's how bad it is, Lynn. Three guidebooks came out about Beaufort, South Carolina in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
In all three of them, I was listed as a native.
A man who moved 23 times before he was 15 years old, and you're a native of Beaufort.
And I just loved it. I did nothing to correct it. I just adored that fact.
Oh, Pat, thank you. Thank you very much, and a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you very much. Lots of love.
Take care. Pat Conroy is author of the Pat Conroy Cookbook, Recipes of My Life. Now, Pat left us with his recipe for cocktail pecans, and I think you know where to find it, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And from all of us here at the Splendid Table to everybody at your house, have a great Thanksgiving. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Anonymous, who said, "At Thanksgiving, all of America sits down to dinner at the exact same time. Halftime." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to check out our weekly newsletter while you're there and details about our spring trip to Italy, to Tuscany and Emilia-Romagna. Now, additional support for our program comes from Starbucks, collecting books and toys at neighborhood locations for this year's Holiday Angels Joy Drive. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great holiday. Join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.